So we're on lesson 10. This is not a kindling lesson. Therefore, we have no fire. This is to avoid forest fires rather than kindling up something. So this is one of those lessons where there's a lot of trepidation for me to teach it because we have taught it wrong for so long and we've made it such an emphasis that I don't want to make it an emphasis. So I want to make sure that we have it in context so that we don't do what we've been doing for a couple hundred years. We've just come from Paul telling Timothy that he should not be distracted by opponents of the truth and that he should deal with all men gently, that he should come alongside them because they are opponents to themselves, and so that he should feel compassion for them and come alongside them. And he's also made a point of telling Timothy and telling us who we are. Our identity is images of God. And all of our actions and interactions, all of our connections should be coming out of being an image of God. No other identity should be directing our behavior toward one another, but image of God. Now then, we come though to chapter 3, which is a really harsh chapter. And it's very possible to be jarred into, how does that fit? Except that because we so often don't read in context, I think most people go, oh, well, yeah, we know about this. We should avoid evil men. But you should be jarred because it seems so opposite to what Paul has been telling us. So what's going on here? Why does it take such a drastic turn? Why does Paul all of a sudden start talking this way? We're going to encounter last days and difficult times and evil men all in the next couple verses. So what I want you to do, as we're talking about this, we're going to talk about it isolated. I want you to start thinking about the lessons from last week, about how we're to deal with all men, what it means to live the gospel, to know that grace is the connection, and that our obligation is to live grace and to live reminding people that the connection has already been made and that they're worthy because of that connection already being made. I want you to think through that and think through how in the world could that be attached to this? Because it seems like just the opposite. I want you to think about that. And we'll get to why it's coming here. So first of all, I'm going to deal with it in isolation. We'll deal with these people and what Paul thinks that we should be doing with them and kind of go from there. So what we're seeing here is the trajectory of an earned worth life. So we've talked about the gospel is connection's already been made, therefore I have worth because Christ has already made connection with me. I didn't make the connection. I didn't have to come up with my own worth because I was good enough or smart enough or wise enough to make the connection. He made it, and I've seen it. Somebody showed it to me, and I'm enjoying it. But the other side is the earned worth. I was smart enough to do this. I am good enough to do this. I work hard enough to make a connection. I work hard enough to keep those connections. So what Paul shows us is what the trajectory looks like for an earned worth life. These are people, the people that he's talking about here, who have been in that kind of a paradigm. That's what they've lived. So he starts out with, realizes that in the last days, so we need to talk about last days. And we always, whenever we see last days, particularly in the New Testament, we always think, oh, that means, you know, the very end of time. And Paul is saying, you know, in the last days, it's coming soon. And yet it didn't come. Paul didn't know when the last days were. I want us to look at it a little differently. Yes, it does mean that, but I don't actually think that's where Paul's going with this. I think what he's saying is for any person's last days, for the end towards of their life, not physical life, but the kind of goal of where they've gotten to. What has come, what have they been working toward? And he's saying, these people, this is what they've been working toward, getting here. So does that give you a little different slant on last days? So he's talking about what it looks like when you start in with a transactional life and you practice that transactional life and you cultivate that transactional life. What comes of that? This is what comes of that. So last days of ourselves, last days of what we've been practicing, what does it start to look like? They haven't just been ignorant of connection, and they haven't just neglected connection here and there. They've practiced it. They've cultivated disconnection. They've remained steadfast in their own gospel of striving, and they are entrenched in a transactional paradigm, and they can't see it because they're so entrenched.
Is Paul still talking? No. Is Paul?
Yes. Yep.
Is he still talking to believers? Because I know at the last...
Yeah. So remember the last chapter, he's telling Timothy, you're dealing with people in the church. But he said, and he makes this qualification, I want you to deal with all men this way. I want, no matter what. Now he's back to dealing with people in church. Okay, so, and we'll see that in just a second.
Did you turn on the tape?
I did. The problem is they can't see it. The very first time that we ever in Bible study started talking about a transactional life, it was really tough for us to kind of understand that and to see it in ourselves because it's how we've lived, right? We are so entrenched. This is how the world lives. We've certainly taken it in the church. This is just how it is. So the transactional life, once you get entrenched in that, actually we're all entrenched in that, once you don't even realize that you're being transactional. You think you're being good. So you need to understand that everyone we talk about in here does not think that it's ugly. They actually think that they're doing well. They think, because in a what's the goal of a transactional life? If I do this, I get this. So if I behave well, I will be a good Christian. So I'm a good Christian because I've behaved well. So they've convinced themselves, sometimes us, we've convinced ourselves that we are a good Christian because we've behaved this way, because that was our paradigm. If I behave well, then I'm a good Christian. So understand that this is the trajectory of their life. They just don't see it as this ugly. Difficult days. The words actually mean to reduce the strength. And since strength in 2 Timothy, where does strength come from? 2 Timothy 2:1.
Power. Courage.
Strengthened in grace, it says. Be strong in grace. This is where the strength is supposed to come from. And yet, this says difficult times will come. In fact, what he's saying is there will come times in the last days of people's lives, in the accumulating of being in a transaction life, that their strength in grace has been reduced. They're not finding strength any longer in grace. They're finding it in will, in power, in striving. And so their real strength has been reduced. In fact, it's been reduced so little that they have no idea that they have no strength because they're doing so well. They're producing good works as they see it. They go to church 8 times now instead of 7 times. They're doing better and better at this. So they don't notice it, but it's difficult days because their strength has been reduced to almost nil. So in the last days, difficult times will come. For men will be lovers of self. And what I want you to see is that is the, you can just end it there. Men will be lovers of self instead of lovers of God. You could take all that and just compress it and say, they'll be lovers of self rather than lovers of God. What Paul is saying here is, if you're in a transactional mode, if that's what you think the gospel is, if I do this, then I'm this. If I behave well, then I'm accepted. I have worth. This is what it will look like down the road if you keep holding on to that kind of a gospel. It will constrain you gradually so that it burdens you, so that you don't even notice or recognize that your actions are ugly. And you become a lover of self. And when you're a lover of self, what you've done is cultivate disconnection, right? Because if you're a lover of self, that means that's what comes first. And if you come first, you have essentially disconnected from relationship. The word lover of self means one whose primary concern is that things be easy and pleasant for himself. Oh, yeah, that hurt, didn't it?
Can you repeat it?
Lovers of self means one whose primary concern is that things be easy and pleasant for himself. That probably hurts right at the core, right? That's what it means to be a lover of self. That's actually what it means to live a transactional life. Everything I do is geared toward making sure that my life is easy, is comfortable, is pleasant, looks good, right? Everything I do. That means I'm a lover of self. That means that's what I'm all about. They've bought into the lie of a different identity rather than image of God. They are living as reflectors of self rather than reflectors of God. So that anytime we defend or fight any of those little identities we talked about last week, any of those, we are being lovers of self. So I want you to think about that through in a minute. Because if we do that, if we are so holding on to any identity other than image of God, essentially what happens is we begin to have to feed that identity. And we have to make sure that that identity is okay. So because I'm introvert, it makes me comfortable, because that's what happens. Identities say, I'm comfortable in this. So I'm comfortable in this way of dealing with things. I'm not comfortable in this way. And so I don't know how to do it, so I just won't do it. So Rob and I had a discussion this week where I said, you know, I'm an introvert. I don't know how to deal with this kind of situation. You know, these are relationship situations, and my desire is I'm just going to pull out. I'm not going to do anything with relationships here. But I knew that what I was doing then was I was protecting the identity of an introvert instead of the image of God. I was being a lover of self, and I knew I couldn't do that. So then you have to navigate. So what then does it look like? What does it look like to be an image of God when it's not comfortable for me? There's a very different. But if I'm so sure that this is who I am, and I will make sure that everything fits in there so that that identity makes me feel comfortable, it's really, every one of those identities are boxes where we go, okay, I know the rules about this identity, so I can be comfortable here, and I can stay in here, and I can be good. Image of God, that's way too messy. Image of God is way too, like, I have to evaluate everything. And that's true, and that is very true. But it definitely takes a lot more thought, doesn't it? So, to say, how am I the image of God here, rather than, it's very easy for us to stay in our identity, because we know what makes us feel comfortable, right? All of that to preface all of these next things, because all these next things sound horrible, right? And I bet you any one of you read through that and said, I don't do that. 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 And then you realize, oh, wait, these are expanded definitions of lover of self, of someone who's holding on to a transactional way to get self to feel comfortable and pleasant and good about it. So I did want to take a lot of time in defining all these, so I wrote the definitions for you so that you didn't have to sit there and write them through, but we'll go through real quick and then come back to those. So a lover of self, looks like a lover of money. And actually, it just means coveting. Someone who covets, someone who desires more for themselves. They're boastful. They assert their own goodness. Arrogant. They prefer self. They look to their own interests first. I hope what happens is, as you're reading these definitions, you absolutely know the opposite is found in Scripture of the character, right? Absolutely the opposite. Reviler is someone who destroys another's good name, usually through gossip. Stubborn to honor parents. I didn't put one down because that's basically what it means. They don't want to point out connection with parents. Thankless, without appreciation of other service or time. And I want to stop here for just a minute. It's really easy to go through these and pick out people you know who fit these. And I'll be really honest, because of where we're going through this, it was very easy for me to pick out leaders in the church that have these. And I struggle with that because I see it. Having been on staff and having been very intimate with several staffs, it's prevalent. It's prevalent. But that doesn't mean that's the only place it's at, right? It's in us as well. So we have to balance that. We have to make sure that we're looking at us as well.
To that point, like when we started talking about transactional, like all of a sudden it was very easy for me to find all the ways that everybody else was being transactional. But it wasn't until I started saying, but that's a mirror of what is in me.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
That's what's taken longer. So
right.
It wasn't even embracing the idea of being transactional.
Uh-huh.
Because that was easy, embracing that.
Yeah.
And I could find it in everybody. It was the fact that I hadn't recognized that was a mirror of what was in me.
Right.
And that was what took the longest part. And then that's the ugly part.
Yeah, right, exactly. And yet that's also the freeing part, right, when we get to that.
I'm trying to visualize this, and the word philos autos, AUTOS. I was just thinking of that picture of it just gives you that sense of automatic, it's going back to you.
Yep.
And I was thinking about how essentially it's. I mean, these are how do you use money? Is it coming back to you? How do you use words? Are they about coming back to you? How do you use, you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
All these different kinds of things. It's not even about the things.
Right, exactly.
Are those in this or are they in this?
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's the opposite of reflect. We're not reflecting God, we're deflecting.
Mm-hmm.
So we're making sure it comes back to us
mm-hmm.
so that the glory, the shine comes to us rather than. Yep, so that's exactly what all of these are, is these are just little ways that kind of it gets manifested, that.
Okay.
So, thankless, without appreciation of others' service or time. Unholy, without divine character. In other words, not whole. And this one's actually a big deal here. The inside doesn't match the outside. So there's not a wholeness at all. Unloving, that means without family love, actually. So, hesed, we don't treat others as if they're in family. Irreconcilable, always in a state of war, refusing to lay aside enmity or listen to terms of reconciliation. Remembering that, and we'll get to that in a minute, that these are people within the church. I think that one is an interesting one because we have elevated this. We have elevated this as the pinnacle of who we are as believers. How have we done that? Are we not proud that we are against? Are we not proud that we are against every sin imaginable? We're proud of that. You see what I mean by when you're trapped in the transactional paradigm, you think you're doing good. We think it's good to be against. We have for years now, decades now, said we're of course, and people shouldn't make us feel bad for being against things, but we're actually against people. And yet, that's what irreconcilable means, to always be at war, to always be against. Gossips, those who falsely accuse and divide people. Again, we pride ourselves in having different denominations all over the place. I just saw, okay, I'll give you an example of this. So one of the big news in Christianity in the last week has been, and I wonder if you know this, Linda, the biggest Swedish evangelical preacher in Sweden just converted to Catholicism. Now, for me, as soon as I saw this, I went, oh my gosh, how about that? Because I personally know the man. This is who Christian lived in Syria with, his son. This Christian and Lissa traveled with him in Israel. So I know the whole background. And I'm going, wow, this is really interesting and cool, because he's very big on ecumenism. The problem is, what do you think that I've seen in the news? Horrible things. Horrible things. How could this man do this? He's the devil. You know. So I've read lots and lots and lots of things here. They don't want what Mr. Ekman is embracing. The interesting thing is, his evangelical slant was prosperity gospel, basically. A very Swedish slant on it, but it was also David Cho's?
Cho.
Yeah, that was his church. That he was actually, he founded this. So anyway, all that to say, dividing people. We're so good in the Christian community about dividing people, and we think it's a good thing. And we think it's good that we're slandering, basically. I mean, that's all I saw was slander in so many of these reports. Without self-control, powerless, incontinent, losing your temper, that kinds of things. Brutal, fierce, savage, just plain old mean. Haters of good. I forgot to put the definition in here. What they hate is the practice of good and anyone who practices good. Now, let's remember what we've defined as good. What are good works? Naming, tending, and multiplying. That's what it means when it talks about good works. So these hate naming worth in people. They hate you to point out that Christ is already connected to them. No, no, no. They've got to do something about that connection. Don't do that. Don't point out that they've connected to God. Don't tend to them. Don't come alongside them and be with them. Separate from them, right? So we have that, and that looks good. That looks like a good thing to do. Treacherous, betrayer, traitor, giving in to the enemy's hands. In other words, leading people into transactional paradigms. That's giving in to the enemy's hands. Reckless, rash. They run headlong into doing things and projects and things without ever listening, without ever coming alongside and being with. Boy, I wrote these way too small for my eyes here. Conceited, prideful, insolent, we know these. Lovers of pleasure. In other words, they delight in following the lusts. And we talked last week about lusts. Those are ways of satisfying yourself, making yourself feel good, making yourself feel like a good Christian, or building yourself up, working toward being worth something, being valuable. So lots of stuff there. I wasn't even going to put that list because there were so many things, because I don't want us to get sidetracked into it's being a lover of self. And he's saying, this is what's going to be happening. This is the trajectory of a life that's lived as earned worth, as you have to do something good to be considered good. You have to do something in order to get connected. You have to do something and your life will be good.
You know, for years when I would get to this part in 2 Timothy, my mind always did a shift to out of the believer and into the unbeliever. Mm. And so I think that's where it's like, I don't know, it's just like I just always did that shift. So then I never felt like those were characteristics of if I was truly a Christian. Those are not characteristics.
Right.
That, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yes. And that's pretty much what we always do. We see something bad and we say, oh, that's outside the church. And yet Paul says over and over again, I never tell you to avoid those outside the church. ever. He said, that's your whole point of being. These are people in the church. Because then it says, they hold to a form of godliness. They hold to it. They put it up as a mask. They have a form here, and they practice that form. They practice these masks of, these are good. This is what it means to be a good Christian. This is what it means to be a follower. This is what it means to be whatever you want to call it, but good. And what Paul is trying to do is unmask how ugly it really is. And this is why I kind of didn't want to list it. We look at those, and we still have a hard time saying, oh, those are people within the church. Maybe even me. That would be just really difficult for us to say. So it's much easier for us to say, it's those people, right? It's someone else there.
For me, I felt like it kind of did the opposite.
Yeah.
I almost felt, this last week as I was going through it, there was almost like a freeing more than I felt like that other way.
Okay, that's interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah, like, okay, these are things that I have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that are a part of my life, but I still have my connection with God.
Right, right.
And I just need to,
right.
You know, I don't know, I guess maybe my years when I was younger, it was always like, if those were there, my connection wasn't there.
Yes.
Was I really, truly a Christian?
Right, right.
Was I really, yeah.
Right. So he wants us to look at these, and he wants us to recognize them in ourselves and in other people. Notice, though, that the verb for all of these is in the present tense, which means these are practiced. These are practiced. So all of these things are practiced. Basically, you practice being a lover of self. You practice that transactional paradigm. They don't consciously believe they're doing bad things. They don't consciously believe that they would never consider themselves a reviler or a coveter or someone who's boastful or arrogant or thankless or unloving. And yet, in the day-to-day, that is what they practice over and over again. But their form is holding up, I'm godly and I'm good, and this is why I do this. I'm irreconcilable. I'm against because I have to protect the church. I am dividing people because, well, they're them and they're not us, and we've got to, you know, protect. I'm a hater of good in that. No, we can't tell people that they're connected. You can't tell people they're connected. That's horrible. You got to make sure that they know that they got to do something to be connected, because then they'll never do it. So do you see that there's this funny flip? We look at it and it looks blatant, but there's this flip that we have, you know, that if transactional paradigm is how we live the gospel, then these things are what we are. This is how we look at things all the time. So that there's a cultivation of disconnection with people. Obviously, every one of these things, you have to be disconnected, right? This is all about building you up and separating yourself from. There is cultivation of forms, of masks, of ways to look good on the outside, to put these in a different light. And there's cultivation of power. So in transactional paradigms, I'm always suckling on my own power, my own ability, my own striving, my own strength to be good. So the thought of being vulnerable and saying, I'm weak, I'm needy, I don't do this well, I can't connect here, I can't. The thought of being vulnerable is the last place these people want to go. And I hate to say this, but I'm going to share this because it's more common than you think. When I was on staff in a church, we had an all-staff meeting. And it was all about, and these were almost the words. We were told, do not let anyone know that you have any problems. Don't tell anyone. Don't ever talk about it. I don't ever want to hear that. That's what was told us. Basically, do not be vulnerable. Because you represent the staff. You represent the super spiritual. You represent the leaders. That's what happens when we live in a transactional paradigm. We've got to hold up that standard, right? And see, the freedom of the gospel is you don't have to hold up any standard.
That's one of the problems with the Catholic Church molesting young children. They didn't address that.
Well, it's interesting that you would say that, Pat, because I just read an article that said sexual molestation is a bigger problem in the Protestant Church than it is in the Catholic Church.
And I was going to say, it's across all religions.
It is across all religions.
But
yes.
I mean, it got to be a bigger problem because they didn't admit it. It wasn't addressed. People needed to say, I have a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm vulnerable.
Like
I need help.
Right, exactly.
Just
exactly.
Like your question today.
Right, exactly. The vulnerability part, you know, we talk about vulnerability a lot. I hope you understand the importance of that, because that's what says, I need the gospel. I'm so thankful for the gospel. I'm thankful for the connection. In a transactional paradigm, vulnerability is the last thing you want to have. Because you're building up yourself so that you are worthy and valuable. And if I'm vulnerable to say, you know, I don't do that well, I really messed that up, and I messed that up, then you haven't built yourself up, and now you're not worthy. And now, in fact, in a transactional paradigm, in a community where it's transactional and you're vulnerable, what happens?
You're shut out.
You're shut out. Mm-hmm. They have to. Because what are we going to do with that? Our whole system is built up on you being better and better and you being working harder and harder, and all of a sudden you say, you're not working hard, you've messed this up. Well, it doesn't fit in a transactional paradigm. So you see what happens within those kind of communities? It's really serious when we look at that. And yet, that's what Paul is telling us is, this is what happens. This is the end results of what happens is, we become these people and we don't even know it. We don't even realize that we are doing exactly opposite of what the gospel has called us to do.
You know, we just had this, we kind of had, that conversation was never had on our staff. But I think all of us in any team, that's implicit.
Yes.
Just be your best and look really good and like you have it together. Because the more together you are, the more together what we're doing is.
Right, I mean? Right, exactly. And then the more valuable it is.
Right. And no one says that necessarily, or it seems, yeah. So it's implicit. But anyway, I think like a couple weeks ago, we were kind of going around and people were like, okay, you give a report on how like your ministry is doing, right? You know, how shiny what you're doing is.
Right.
And how like awesome what your contribution is and blah, blah. And they got to me, and I, you know, I kind of was doing that. I mean, it feels good to be like, yes, so we had 43 women go to the domestic violence shelter, and da, 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 this many people are doing this, and blah, blah. And like, anyway, for some reason, I was like, okay, you're not going to say that. And I got tired and tired, weaker in being able to say that. So anyway, I was like, well, okay, I think my report right now is that I was in my car crying today, that I totally didn't, you know, anyway, just like, there was nothing shiny. I'm like, I just can't say something shiny right now. It's nothing shiny. But anyway, afterwards, like a few days later, somebody else from the team called me and were like, I need to meet with you. I need wholeness. I thought we were all supposed to just pretend we're successful. Do you know what I mean? Like, and now I'm realizing, like, all I really needed is for someone to say, I fail, and only Christ succeeds. You know, I fail, and I fail, and I fail. Anyway, it was just interesting when it stopped being, like, loving ourselves and how valuable we're all in this team. Mm-hmm. That we're like, I'm not really valuable. I mean, I am valuable, but not because of what I can tell you right now.
Right,
in these
exactly.
2 minutes.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was really powerful because now I feel like everybody on the team is actually seeking wholeness versus shininess.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where we're at. That's what Paul's talking about. I really want to get to our fun thing, so I'm going to get through here. So, the trajectory of an earned worth life is that they cultivate disconnection. They cultivate forms of godliness, and they cultivate power, which means they avoid vulnerability. They avoid connection, real connection. On the outside of it, it looks like they're really connected. So I'll tell you another practice that was on that staff. We were told that you have to take one person out to lunch from the congregation every week. And the church is paying for that, and you will pay. You will pay the bill. Now, I want you to think about that. The money that you gave to the church is going to take you out to lunch, mm-hmm. so that it looks like we're connecting with you. The problem is, when you say, "Oh no, that's okay, I'll pay," and I hated this, but you had to say, "No, I'll pay," but you didn't say, "Well, I'm paying because this is part of my job. I have to do this. I invited you out because I have to. In fact, I have to report who I did, where I went, how much I spent. That was part of the job." And Bill and I were talking about this the other day. Somebody came up and I said, "Oh, I really liked that guy. He was such a nice guy." And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "You know, I felt so good too because he one time asked me to lunch." Oh. And I thought, I wonder if Bill remembers this. Mm-hmm. And Bill said, "But you know that I found out that he had to." And that just made it worse. It was horrible. Mm-hmm. That, so they cultivate forms of godliness. They cultivate ideas that they are connected, and yet they're doing it so that they look good, which means they're actually cultivating disconnection. So they cultivate disconnection, they cultivate forms, they cultivate their own power, and let go of vulnerability and connection and wholeness. What's their progress? According to Paul in here, it said that they will make no further progress in verse 9. It will not continue. And he reckons that to Jannes and Jambres. Anybody know who Jannes and Jambres is? No.
Snake.
So they are the priests of Pharaoh that actually kind of did, you know, the contest with Moses and Aaron. So when Moses and Aaron would, you know, say, "I'm going to do this," and the priests of the Pharaoh would say, "Oh, we can do that. We can do that too." They kept performing good works, just like Moses did. So remember that all the ideas of Egypt are transactional world. That's what Egypt stands for, is transactional world. And so these are priests of the transactional world. And they are displaying the same good works as Moses is, who is displayed as the one who frees from transactional world, right? And they're doing the same tricks. You know, we're doing the same good works as you, same good works, until Moses, it's actually Aaron, but Aaron throws down the stick and the serpent, and it becomes a serpent. And the priests throw down a stick and they become a serpent. And you go, see, we can do the same thing. We do good works too. But what happens to their serpent? It gets eaten up by Moses' serpent. So it's the beginning of, it looks good, but we will eat it up. God's work will eat that up. There will be nothing left of that. And from there on, we see these magicians not only not able to perform the same works, but actually succumb to the boils that come next, and the deaths of their firstborn. And so that they succumb. So in the end, so in the last days of these priests of transactional ways, they have these same things happen to them, that the destruction that...
You know, mm-hmm. not like kindling the yep. flame. It's like yep. you burn out.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. Which is exactly why I didn't want to have a fire. It's not a kindling here. This is a forest fire. It burns everything up. It completely destroys everything. Mm-hmm.
Death versus life, what fire can do.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we talk about the fire giving us warmth and it heats our food. It was the most precious gift you could give, Matthew tells us. And yet it's also something that can destroy. And so the progress of them won't continue forever, because the boxes of transactional ways, the boxes that we put in, they only have a certain amount of air. And after a while, there's no air left. There's nothing to breathe in there. All the space and oxygen will be used up. And it will be obvious that there's no growth and there's death. So their progress won't continue. They will go from bad to worse. It actually just says they will go worse, is what it says in the Greek. What it means is the evil keeps piling up over and over again. The evil, remember the evil being independence. The independence keeps piling up. I'm going to be more independent here. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it myself. I'm going to get better. I'm going to be a better Christian. I'm going to be at church six times instead of five. I'm going to have more ministries. I'm going to be more involved. I'm going to have more events. I'm going to do this. And it gets so piled up that the separation becomes more and more obvious, that their choice is to separate, their choice is to build themselves up and separate rather than be vulnerable and dependent. And it will affect both self and others, because it says they will be deceiving others and being deceived. The words there mean to roam from safety and reality. They have lost their way and they're leading others, and they have no idea that they've lost their way. They're still merrily on their way. Yep, we're doing the greatest thing. We're building churches. We're doing this. We're doing that. We're doing great things for the Lord. And then the Lord said, but I never knew you. You were doing it all so that you were lifted up and not the Lord. Fulfillment of their purpose. So their purpose is to show worth on their own. Their purpose basically is to be disconnected. That's their purpose. And so Paul says at this point, he says, what do we do with them? Then we avoid these men. And this is where I think it gets really tough. The responsibility of avoiding these men then goes to those who are living the gospel of grace. All of a sudden now, when you are connected with the gospel of grace, you're responsible to avoid these men. Let's pull that apart, because this is where I think we get a little dangerous. When? And here's the important part. Where does this come, first of all, within Paul's letter? Is it toward the end? It's in the middle, right? It's in the middle. The first part of Paul's letter and the last part of Paul's letter is all about gospel, living grace. So, it comes in the middle. And it comes right after he's been very extensive about being gentle with all men, showing them their connection, tending to them, being with them, allowing them to see that they're connected, their worth is there, they don't have to work for it, and showing them where they've neglected connection and being with them to practice connection and to cultivate connection so that when Paul says avoid such men, it cannot come until you have done that. Until you, the one who's embracing the grace, until you have actively pursued naming and tending with these people. It can't come before you have taught them with gentleness, with grace, that you've shown them connection, you've corrected them gently by reminding them of what their real identity is, that they are an image of God, helping them to see the places where their connection has been neglected, being with them and helping them pay attention to connection. You cannot avoid until you have named and tended. The problem that we've had is we've gone to this passage, and there's only five other passages that even talk about this in the whole of Scripture. We've gone to those as soon as someone has a sin, right? This is what we need to do. We need to avoid them. They're boastful. We need to avoid them. They've committed a sin. We need to avoid them. or even if it's gone to, well, they've done this so many times and we have to avoid them. But no one ever talks about, let's go and name with them. Let's go and tend with them. Right? Do we ever talk about that when we talk about this? No. We go right to this and we say, well, we just need to separate from them. And see, here's Paul's point. And this is where I always have fear about teaching a passage like this. It does seem harsh. And in a minute we'll see that it's not. But it's a very harsh passage. But it has to come in context. You cannot pull this out of context and say, I see someone who's being a reviler. I see someone who's boastful. I see someone who's being a lover of self. So we need to avoid them. The problem is avoiding them. Thanks, Jen. Avoiding them is easy for us, right? Oh, I just avoid them. I just don't need to have anything to do with them. But our responsibility, Paul says, is first to be spending a lot of time naming them and tending them. Now, I had to think through this. Unfortunately, I have too many people in my life who fit these characteristics. And some of them are paying the price now. Not all. And I had to sit back and go, okay, so what is my responsibility here? Can I avoid them? How have I dealt with them in the past? Have I, and I'm looking at this going, oh, I've been combative. I've pointed out how bad they are. I've said, you know, that wasn't a good thing. You know, you can't have this box here. Christ is about freedom. You can't have this. And I've told them that. And I thought I was doing a good thing. And then I sit here and I think, wow, how many times did I ever name them? How many times did I ever tend to them? I didn't. So I can't be avoiding them. Do you see that the responsibility we have here? And there's a little bit more as we go into that. But I don't want us to look at this and go, well, here's a formula for what we do when we see someone sinning. It's not. We take the Matthew passage like that all the time, right? The Matthew 18. You know, if you see someone sinning, and actually the words are sinning against you, you know, call them out on the carpet once, call them out on the carpet twice, call them out on the carpet three times, and then be done with them. Context, guys. Always context. It never can happen unless you have been naming and tending them.
Well, isn't the assumption, too, like, because there's all these passages about, like, well, look, you can't have standards and expectations for people where you've never named and you've never tended and you've never, you know what I mean? So it's almost like under the assumption that this is a situation where you've done all these things. Do you know
yes.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it's not about, like, people outside of the
church. Exactly.
It's more of, like, this is where you've
yep.
named and tended and done all this.
Yep.
Now separate in this situation.
Yep. Yes. And so Paul is saying there does come a point where that you're going to have to do this, but it cannot come until you've already done all that's in 2 Timothy 2. It can't come to that point yet. You cannot take this out and say this is how we do it every time we see it. There's a purpose for it. There is a purpose and a place for avoiding such as these, who practice and cultivate disconnection, who practice and cultivate forms of godliness. The purpose, though, is not for punishment. Because if it's for punishment, you've just entered a transactional paradigm. It is for restoration. It is for connection. When my kids were little and they were fighting, my reaction to them was, you shouldn't go to your own rooms. And what happens? They miss being with each other. And they hated it. It was a place and a time for them to recognize that connection is life, not disconnection. That building yourself up isn't life. It isn't connection. It is an invitation back to connection. You're giving them the opportunity to experience what disconnection really is. It also does guard the gospel as a gift, because if this is allowed to continue, you allow leaders or even people within the body to continue in this, it becomes leaven and it becomes gets through the whole church. Well, yeah, we can build ourselves up. Just, I mean, that's the story of your staff meeting. You know, we were all doing that. You were all doing that, right? Until you came to, no, no, this isn't what we're going to do. Just by being vulnerable and sharing. How? And these are the five passages that talk about it. Number one, you never treat them as an enemy, but as a brother. You never see them as an enemy, but as a brother. You love them with a hard grace, or what we used to call severe mercy. You give them the freedom to choose that disconnected life. But just like God did, when he gave us breath, and he gave us purpose, and he gave us provision, the last provision he gave us was choice, which should be our last provision to someone, is the choice to live disconnectedly. But we give them that freedom. We don't force connection. We invite, and we invite, and we invite, and we invite, until the point comes where it looks like they really, really want disconnection. I'll give them disconnection for a time. It is never permanent rejection, ever. It is not judgment of their worth. It's a judgment for the gospel. It is saying to that person, you're not telling the truth about the gospel. And I don't want you to keep saying that the gospel is a transaction. There's this great article. I would love to read it, but I think I'd rather do our other thing. But there's a beautiful article in Christianity Today this last month on it's lamenting the divided church. And it's talking about the ecumenical movement. But he talks about, he says, what do we do? Let me read some of it. Church turns divisive and ideological when it is severed from the gospel that brought it into being. And at its most simple and radical, the gospel is this. While we were sinners, Christ died for us. God came after sinners who wanted nothing to do with their creator, gathering a community of enemies and making them into a family. The church is the epicenter of enemy reconciliation in the world, starting with the severest estrangement possible between God and humans and working out from there to repair all forms of human estrangement. But what does it mean if what happens if enemies of Christ have snuck inside that church? The matter firmly comes down to how we view the enemy that false teacher has become. Is the heretic, and that's what we're talking about here. In fact, that word gets used. An enemy like Satan to be thrown into the lake of fire, or one of the lost sheep whom Christ goes to great lengths to rescue, the ungodly for whom Christ died. The truth is, no heretic will recover from his heresy as long as the Orthodox permanently reject him. And it goes on. It's a great article on that. That's what he's talking about here. It is not his emphasis of this letter. It is the danger of what will happen if we allow transactional paradigms to stand. It is the danger, not only for those people, but for us as well. It is the danger for us that we could be like this, that we could end up looking like that. What they become is then priests of a new identity, right? We are called to be priests of images of God. They are what Paul calls them is imposters, which actually the word is wizard. They are wizards. They're evil men. And I love the definition of this evil men here. So the words here actually say they are people who do not stop short of demanding the whole strength of man. Mm-hmm. Just the opposite, right, of what Paul has told Timothy. Be strengthened in grace. These are people who demand strength out of the man rather than getting strength out of grace. Do your hardest, do your best, be more godly and more godly and more godly. And so the end result is that they love themselves to death in the midst of working very hard to find life. So I'm going to go back to where we began. We need to ask the question, how did we get here? How does the last chapter inform this chapter? Could it perhaps be the failure to do chapter 2? The failure to tend and name, to see others as opposing themselves, and so to come alongside them? the failure of practicing grace. In other words, neglecting a problem until it got so serious that they've become this. So now think about all those stories we told. That's what's happening here. Paul is saying, if you don't name and tend and give grace, if you ignore the fact that people think they're getting their worth from what they're doing, it will grow, it will be entrenched, and it will become serious, so serious that you might end up in the hospital, that you might be without hair, that you might not be able to be breathing, and everyone thinks you're just fine. It's serious to not live the grace of the gospel. So that's the point of Paul telling. The point is not Paul giving a formula for how to deal with imposters, heretics. The point is, Timothy, it's so important. Get back on the wagon and start naming and tending to people. Start showing them the grace of connection. Because when you don't, the transactional paradigm grows and grows and grows into some horrible cancer. And people don't even recognize that they have a cancer. Don't let it go that far.
One, like the rest of the chapter is just, that's the only antidote.
That's exactly right. The only antidote is live the gospel, live the grace. We are our brother's keeper. In fact, this was Cain's problem, right? Mm-hmm. What I want us to think about is, are we reminding ourselves? And one thing you should do is go back through Paul's letters and see that he reminds himself all the time that he's connected, not because he's great, but because Christ connected him. And he almost always starts, remember how he starts here? I understand that I have been called by the grace of God. I understand that. That's what we did at the very beginning of this semester, is we designed tattoos, remember, that were to remind us that we are not connected by our works, but by God connecting us, that it is by grace. Not grace was there and we saw it and so we ran and got it, but grace came to us. Grace was delivered to us. And so we all made tattoos. Most of us made tattoos. Some of us didn't. Pictures of those. So I want us to understand how important it is that we see this chapter and see it's very subtle. It works very subtle. And all of a sudden, you're in a place that's so serious. All of your examples were perfect. And you came to things that were so serious. And you didn't think much of them until all of a sudden. It can happen to us as well. It can be that subtle. It can happen to any of us. Chris, I think you were really great in pointing out, I look at this list and I realize, well, yeah, sometimes I am that. Sometimes I am thankless. Sometimes I am boastful. Sometimes I am some of these things. Am I letting others tend me in those things? Am I letting others say, you know, you're losing connection here. Let's come together. Am I doing that for others? Am I vulnerable enough to say, man, I'm struggling here. Could you come alongside me? That we recognize that we continually are back over and over again, understanding that if we, without taking any notice, all of a sudden these things can creep up in our life unless we take action early, and in others as well. So what I want us to do is actually give ourselves those tattoos. So I've taken all your tattoos and I will pass them out. And you're actually going to put a tattoo on yourself today.
So is that what you have?
That's what I have right here. Yeah.
Because if you get a tattoo, like, you're going to
I did not.
Oh, okay.
So listen carefully to the directions, okay? And so girls over there, we're going to do it there. So come over here so that you, thank you. So clear that area just a little bit. You're going to do the first part on your own, sitting where you're at. Now, all right, I'm going to hand out the sheets. This is everybody's tattoos that did a tattoo.
Do we get to pick where we put the tattoo?
You can choose wherever you want to put it.
You
don't have to choose your own. If you decide you don't like yours, or you see another one that, I like that, or if you even want to make up another one, that's fine. So you can choose whichever one you want to do on you, whichever one will remind you that it is by grace that you're connected, that Christ has connected you, and that your cultivation of that connection is part of you naming and tending others. This should be this great reminder of that. So now that we've gone through some lessons, maybe your ideas have changed about that. So if you test one of these out. So what you're going to do is you're going to choose one of those. Then you're going to trace that onto this transfer paper. It's not transfer paper. It's
tracing paper.
Pass those out on that side. But you have to do it, and just so you know, in case you want to do this at home with your, I think your kids would love this, you have to use gel pens. So it has to be a gel pen that you use it with. So go ahead and trace it. Put enough ink on it. So as you're tracing it, put enough ink on it. I noticed I did this. Now this is a day and a half old, and it's almost fading. So it's only gonna last a day. Don't feel like you can't do it.
Don't feel like, right, exactly.
That's what's
going on. I read an article about a pastor in Florida who paid for people who wanted to get tattoos.
Oh yeah, interesting. So go ahead and trace on the tracing paper.
With the gel pen.
And make sure you put down enough ink on it. After I did this one, I thought, next time I would choose one that had a little more colored into it, you know, not just lines, because mine's just lines. So I chose the one that, it's a real one. You see the real one where it's the cross that looks like it's stitched. It looks like a wound that's stitched up into a cross.
I love that.
Just make it a little bit thicker so there's a little bit more line.
Like make the stitches thicker, you mean?
Yeah.